Do what you can with it. In the light, say, of some of the reading materials. As far as your linguistic skills can get you. As exhaustive as possible. That's why I suggest you don't have a massive text. I prefer that. All the time we work globally and we work as we throw everything at the discourse that we have. I prefer that as an approach to teaching people discourse analysis than, say, giving you a text and say, trace the cohesion by reference in this text, right? Or giving you another text and saying, you know, what are the cohesive devices here? I take that for granted that you could go through a text and find the cohesive devices. What I want to know is how does that fit with everything else that's going on? Ultimately, the demands of discourse analysis is that you have a very complete linguistic theory and descriptive model, and one which does attempt to link the internal patterns of language to culturally predictable social patterns. So that's why, for example, if you read the biogenetic situation and register article, and I've given you some of the articles that I've written, where we are attempting to have a framework that can describe the conditions in which discourse occurs, socio-political conditions under which people do discourse. See, discourse is a social act. It's a social act, therefore it's a political act, it's an economic act. In the full sense of the word economic. We can pretend that a sentence structure is something that can be abstracted from the patterns of human and social living, but you cannot pretend that any discourse is so abstract. And, you know, also behind what I'm suggesting is one thing Ron is concerned with is an investigation in the way of why the language system is what it is. You know, if one follows up Halley's point of view that the language system is what it is because of the demands made on it by speakers and writers of the language, it is only by examining discourse that we find the nature of those. And I'd like to give you, just say, a few what you might call crude examples of that. From two, say, features of the system of English in the late 20th century, the last quarter of the 20th century, compared, say, to earlier periods. And one of the things you'd find about the system of English in the late 20th century, comparing it to 200 years ago, 300, 500 years ago, any one of those things that modern English has, an increase in nominalization. Increase in passive constructions, increase in hypotactic rather than paratactic recursion. There are three features that increasingly characterize English over its developments in the last 2 to 3 centuries. And I think it's a very legitimate question as to ask why. Why is there more nominalization? In other words, those events are nominalized rather than built by clause, by an increase in passive constructions, by an increase in hypertaxis rather than paratactic recursion. And the answer is going to have to lie in the demands being made on discourse and language. And what do you think they are? What things could put together?
More aggressive.
Aggressive?
Social.
That this would cause an increase in normalization? Yes, sir?
Well, I would think that the normalization is useful when you want to sort of hide the fact of events, so that you say that something you put it in the past, you make it a thing instead of a happening, and
this is often called this sort of process is thingification, isn't it? Right? Thingification.
And that is becoming increasingly more useful to speakers as, I suppose, as things have progressed. I suppose you can talk about a number of social phenomena over this time period.
Now, one of the things that I think is an interesting point, I want to, I may put a number of things down here. Kandor's suggestion is, what you're really saying is the idea that nominalization can be used, if you like, as a disguise of the actuality of things, right? It treats them as though they were given. Treat something as though it was given.
How about something like the rise of industrialism, plus the fact that we have communication systems that are so much more advanced and networkish, and I think that would be another reason. Like, you wouldn't say the making of cars or something. You know, what I'm saying is because these become common in everyday...
Car manufacturers.
Right, exactly.
We make cars, right? Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one, and I think you've heard me talk about this aspect of it, which often can be, if you like, ideologically, socio-politically motivated, right? However, there can be socio-political motivations to that. For using nominalizations, because they can disguise the eventuality of something and treat it as something given. You see, one of the things about things is what we think about things, they exist, don't they? But events, we know, may or may not happen. They needn't happen. If you start treating events as though they were things, then it's you have to accept them.
But also, the thing is...
However, the point I want to get back goes back to Glenn's. This wasn't how it started in the language. The increase in memorization, we've got a pretty good way of tracing it, began with the development of science. It began the development of science. Now, it then can be used for various other discoursal, rhetorical reasons which the society demands. But probably the biggest single social movement was the growth of science that led to memorization. That obviously that did not begin in English, it began in fact in Greek, but as science grew inside the English speaking community, so did nominalization. And that's because science tries to deal with what is not particular. Any event, which is what caused us, is something particular, isn't it? Unique. Whereas science tries to sum up what is non-particular, non-unique, what is generalized. So you talk about the condensation of steam. You don't say when steam condensed into water. You don't say that because that suggests it's an activity that only happens once. You want to talk about every time you get condensation, such and such holds good. So you normalize the process. Now, one of the things that has happened, why we think of this, what I might call the political rhetorical use, political in the narrow sense of political manipulation of the language, is, of course, there's a pseudo-scientificism going on there. But because science has high prestige in a culture, in a communicating community context, then all sorts of activities become, inverted commas, scientific-like, because that makes them impressive, it's prestigious. And a great deal of political explanation and political takes on that character. But because science again was the origin of an increase in passive constructions. Was it science? Because what became part of the scientific ethos is that the individual who does something is not what's at issue or risk, but the behavior of what is done, the regularity in the behavior of what's done. So if you're reporting an experiment, you don't say, when I add hydrogen to oxygen, right, with two parts of hydrogen and one to oxygen, I always get water. In other words, I make water that way. What you do say is, if two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen are mixed, the result is water. It doesn't matter who the hell does mix it. A great property of yours. So the passive type construction, if you like, of that type of rationale in science. Now, again, as I suggested before, this also means that you can be, both of these mean you can be agentless. This agent is not important. So a nominalization cuts out agent, and so does the passive. Now, there's a good reason why science is agentless. But that can then be used for other rhetorical purposes. And believe it or not, even this third one, increase in hypertactic rather than paratactic, is also its origin is in science. Now, there's something else that all this also means. All three of these coincide with something else. They all coincide with. What have we been talking about here? In terms of my genetic situation, we've been talking about what experience is being related to, what field gives rise to an increase in a certain type of structure inside the system of language. So this has been, if you like, experience-oriented. But there's something else that was happening during the increase of all these structures, which is doesn't belong to the experience relationship, but to what are the three relationships of genetic situation? Experience, interaction, and medium. Medium relationships. All this goes with the rise and predominance of the written or printed word. All these three features. Written, printed. And believe it or not, that also this also has, if you like, a third correlate, and that does belong to interaction. All this belongs to an interaction which aims to be non-particular and impersonal. What might call if the you know the apparent contradiction of an impersonal interaction. But that, of course, is a product when you have the experience of science. And the medium of written and print, you're going to have basically an impersonal type of interaction, relationship. So it's a genetic situation, a very high abstract genetic situation, which begins to establish itself in a culture that ultimately gives rise to the use of certain types of structure.